Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present. Would Representative O'Driscoll, do you have a motion to approve the minutes?
I do.
Okay, Representative O'Driscoll moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes of January 26th are approved. We will move to House File 110, Representative Kahn.
Madam Chair,
Representative Nelson.
I'll move House File 110 to be passed and to be re-referred to the State Government Finance.
Okay, Representative Nelson moves House File 110 be passed and be re-referred to State Government Finance. Representative Kahn, please proceed.
Madam Chairman and members, it's a pleasure to be before this committee that I've served on for so many years, and I miss being with you this year.
But, we miss you too.
Anyway, this is just an issue, I think, of common sense and legislative information issue, so I didn't bother to bring people to testify for it. I don't know if there's anyone to testify against it. Pensions are one of the most difficult issues that the legislature deals with. If you vaguely look through the business sections of newspapers, there's a pension issue in them every day. I think the New York Times today has an issue on Moody's starting to look at state government pension obligations as part of their bond ratings and so forth. It's a really difficult issue. I remembered when I was Speaker D. Long was the first person who put me on the Pension Commission, and she put me in Representative Mindy Greiling, who was really one of the smartest people in the legislature, on the Pension Commission. And we went through a whole set of meetings where I think I'm just a lot better at bluffing it. And finally, near the end, and Mindy said she felt, we both felt we were hanging on by our fingernails trying to grasp this topic, except, as I said, I faked it better. And at one point, near the end, I asked some really stupid, uninformed question, and Mindy felt this great feeling of relief that I didn't understand it any better than she did. I was just faking it. But the thing I felt really bad about in the Pension Commission, and we would have this problem, and former members, current members, I guess we're still current members until the new members are appointed, Mike Nelson will point out, is that you'll get a bill and it will have some really nice thing to do to somebody, presented as an amendment on the floor of the House, and it's really difficult to deal with. Now, I feel very comfortable bringing the people that are really having a problem with this, and we saw the differences in our caucus when there would at least be four of us to talk about it, is the fact that there is only one minority member. And this has been throughout the years, no matter what the differences are on the Pension Commission. I feel very comfortable bringing this bill today because I consistently brought it when I was in the majority. So I don't feel it's a new position. And so what this does is expands the membership from 5 to 7. And with the requirement that two of the members be minority members, so that there will at least be able to be some discussion in the minority caucus. To prove, now that we've had all this discussion about compromise and all of those things, to prove that compromise doesn't always work, the 1 year that I came closest to getting it passed, the decision was made to put 6 members on the Pension Commission. 6 turns out to be a from each caucus. 6 turns out to be a totally terrible number, because if you look at the numerics of getting a quorum on the Pension Commission, 7 members will make it easier, 6 members makes it harder, and so the one session that we had 6, it was always much more difficult to get a quorum. And so then that was then taken off in the next year. So that's all. I'm open to questions. I was just informed that Kim Crockett, the president of the Minnesota Free Market Institute, is here because she's interested in the bill and thinks it's really important for people to know more about pensions.
Okay. Well, maybe we will take that testimony first if members are okay.
I don't think she necessarily
wants
need
to talk. Okay.
Testify, but she is here if anyone wants to ask her any questions.
Oh, okay. Well, I think this is a good idea because I think that it's important that we have more people who are knowledgeable about pensions, and I think that you made a good point about if there's just one member of the minority and if that person's gone or, you know, for other reasons it doesn't work out, I think it's good to have a few more people and to have a couple of members of the minority on the Pensions Commission that can continue forward with some of that institutional knowledge. So I appreciate you bringing this forward. And do members have any questions? Okay, well, what was that? Oh, Representative O'Driscoll.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, thank you for bringing this forward. I would, just for the record, like to echo some of the things that you had said. We are in some difficult times. Putting more eyes in on these pension bills, I think, is helpful and these pension issues. And there's ever-changing expertise that comes in and out of the legislature, and to be able to tap into that in different ways, I think, makes a lot of sense. And to me, this is something that I think is a bipartisan activity that we can certainly get our arms around. The question that I have is, what have been your stumbling blocks in the past? Is it getting a Senate sponsor, or is it getting some different caucuses to rally around? As a new member, I guess I'm just looking for some background, if I could.
Representative Kahn?
Margaret's laughing. Madam Chairman, the opposition was one senator, Senator Don Betzel, and he had much more control over the Senate members of the Pension Commission, which always made up the conference committee, than we had over the House members. And so that was it.
Thank you.
I'm not entirely sure my senator. Well, you know, the issue is the small, if you believe in control versus information, the small amount of numbers you have are control. So people who believe that the legislature functions best when people are fully informed and making independent judgment run into conflict with the people who believe in tight control. And the Senate is more of a tight control model.
Representative Kahn, do you recall what the biggest size has been since you've been?
It's always been five. And the one time that it went to six.
It's only been five?
I get a nod from the staff.
Okay, are there any other questions from members? And is there anyone who would like to testify on this issue? Okay, well, hearing no further discussion, seeing no amendments, Representative Nelson, would you like to renew your motion?
Madam Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 110 be passed and moved on to the, referred to the State Government Finance Committee.
Okay, all those in favor, say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay.
Thank you very much.
The ayes have it. Motion prevails, and House File 110 is recommended to pass and referred to state government. Okay. What was that? Okay, we were going to have a presentation by the Department of Administration. They want to proceed to the testifying table, witness table. Commissioner Church, would you like to begin and state your name for the record and your title and whatnot?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Ryan Church. I'm the acting commissioner for the Department of Administration. I'm listening to my introductions lately because in the last 3 years I've had three different hats and I've been adding hats and I have to remember which one I'm wearing at any given time. But that's certainly been exciting. I've enjoyed the work, and I think like many of you, especially those of you who are new to the Minnesota legislature, that can be invigorating. Have that new responsibility, puts a little fire in your belly and gets you up in the morning. And I think like many of you, I'm certainly feeling a need to do my very best in making sure that I serve well as a public servant to this great state. And so that's something I think we share. The other thing that's really important as we talk about the Department of Administration is this new sense of urgency for reform in state government and for doing what we can to make sure that state government is as efficient and as effective as possible. And that's just really spot on with what we want to talk about in addressing what the Department of Administration does. So really, our purpose today here is really very simple. It's just to give you an overview of the Department of Administration. And I want to go at that in a couple of ways. First of all, I'm going to do a very brief overview, a little bit about our mission, our goals, snapshot of our budget. And then we're going to move into some sample business areas so you can get a better feel for the kinds of things we do, the approach we take, the innovations that we're working with, results. We don't want to talk about innovation as a theoretical thing today. We want to talk about a real experience, our actual results. And I think we're going to get in a discussion, hopefully, about where are the opportunities going forward. What can we do differently in the future to achieve more, to get better at what we do? So I hope that we can use your time well this morning by giving you that quick overview. I'm not going to talk about everything in the agency. You do have, I believe, a little brochure that just gives a listing of all of the divisions and a one or two sentence introduction to each of those divisions. We can talk about any of them if you have got questions. But we're going to focus our attention a bit more. And I've got four other folks from the department, business managers, who will come up and talk about areas such as purchasing, leasing. We want to talk about an energy conservation piece of work we're doing and seeing some great results. And we also want to talk about the LEAN program, which is just a process to really engage employees across state government in making improvement in the work we do. So if that's all right, Madam Chair, I'll just proceed on that basis.
Please proceed.
Okay. I've got a projection here. I think you've got some slides and a few pieces of paper. I'll just guide us through those as we go. First of all, this slide on who we are. You know, I'm learning something every day on the job, and it was just a couple weeks ago that I realized that the Department of Administration was created in 1939 as a part of a comprehensive effort. It was by Harold Stassen at the time. It was a comprehensive effort to reform and professionalize state government administrative services. And you think about the reforms of the 1930s, and you can probably see that there was likely some really good things that came out of that. There was probably also some things, maybe in the way of unintended consequences, some process, some rules, some structures that actually get in our way. And they become the subject of the reforms today. And as we talk about the examples, I hope you'll see illustrations of that. And again, it's what's going to challenge us to think about how can we do things differently. And I think it's the kind of conversation we need to be having between the executive and the legislative branches. The other thing I want to make sure we get is I think one of the key ideas of those reforms, and one that's still sound today, is the idea of using economies of scale and specialized areas of expertise that can bring value to those services and make them perform more efficiently and effectively. And again, in the examples we'll talk about, you should see how we're leveraging those economies of scale. It's critical to what we do. It's a big part of who we are. And then lastly, I just want to make this point because you might not immediately know this, and I think we look different from many state agencies in this respect. Most of our operations are basically fee-for-service operations. We are a collection of businesses that serve agencies and others and rely not much, at least as a relative percent of our total budget, much less on the general fund. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Our mission is pretty simple. It's to help our customers succeed. Our customers are primarily state agencies, but we also work, as you'll hear, with local government, school districts, colleges and universities, and others. But I think it's simplest just to think of us as a set of businesses that provide service to other state agencies. There's four goals that really guide our agency, and I want to just pause on these for just a moment and talk about them so that you understand why they're important to us, because they're really key to how we manage performance and we monitor what we do. First of all is the goal to provide our customers with valuable services, products, advice, and expertise. When you listen to some of the folks that will come forward today, you will recognize that they have specialized expertise. The other thing that's important to recognize is that, you know, if you're a manager in a state agency and you need to buy a specialized piece of equipment, maybe you have a helicopter and you need to insure it, or you need to insure a zoo, or maybe you're a local law enforcement organization and you have property that you've seized or you have by way of forfeiture. You need to convert that asset into cash. It's really valuable for those folks to be able to turn to an expert and say, I need your help. Can you get me through this quickly and economically? And that's what we have within the Department of Administration. We have people that can do that, not only with their own internal resources, but they can go out to the market and pull in specialized expertise where they need it. Secondly, to be recognized for our innovation and efficiency. You know, because state agencies have ongoing cost pressures, we have to be cost competitive. We've got to be the best deal in town, otherwise we're just not going to stay in business. And if we're not the best deal in town, we're going to be drawing off the resources of those operations. We want to make sure that the state agencies that have your appropriations are able to focus those resources so they can have the greatest impact. And that's not by doing the administrative work of those agencies. That's something we need to help them do as efficiently as possible. Thirdly, to reduce costs by working across government. This gets back to the nub of who we are. It's using those economies of scale. And one example I'll mention here, and you'll hear it come up later, is the cooperative purchasing venture. This is a way that not only state agencies, but local governments, school districts, colleges, and universities can purchase off of state contracts. And that's just a way for us to aggregate that spend, have greater leverage in the marketplace, and extend that benefit beyond just state agencies, but to other jurisdictions of government. Lastly is to offer a safe environment where people thrive and enjoy their work. You know, the word safe has not shown up in the Department of Administration's goals or its mission in the past, but in 2007, the Department of Employee Relations was eliminated, and when that happened, the workers' compensation program for state employees moved to the Department of Administration. And when it did that, we took on a new responsibility. We could see how important it was because of the increased cost of medical care, more sophisticated procedures being used, the aging of our workforce. All of those things have the cost for those kinds of claims on a trajectory that's going way in the wrong direction. Now, we can't control all of those things, but boy, there's never been a better argument for prevention when it comes to employee injury. This is the time, because those costs are increasing, if we can continue the downward slide on the number of injuries or the incident rate, that's the winning game, and that's the one that we want to get good at. So you see that basically these four goals provide a foundation for performance management across a really wide variety of work within the agency. And again, we're not going to go into them all, but we want to give you a sample of what those look like. Let me just give you a quick snapshot of the agency's budget. Again, this might look a little different than budgets that you would look at from other agencies. The largest portions of this pie chart are really representing the fee-for-service activity of the agency. So again, most of our operations are fee-for-service kinds of activities, and you can obviously see that in the budget. The shaded portions kind of at noon and between there and 1 and 2 o'clock are general fund dollars. Now, about half of those go out directly in the way of grants. They are just legislatively appropriated grants that go directly to, for example, public broadcasting is a large grantee. We're not involved in that money. We simply administratively pass it through. The rest of those general fund dollars are, in fact, the general fund dollars that support the core activities within the Department of Administration for which a fee-for-service model just really isn't suitable, or we haven't been able to figure out how to make it work that way, at least at this point. So it's just important to kind of, again, see that that budget might look different than some of the other agency budgets you'd see. Managing performance. I want to talk about this. Again, you're going to hear a lot about this as we go through, and this is really, I think, in many ways, a mindset that we're trying to cultivate within the agency. And I can't claim credit for this. In fact, I was just talking to a member just before this hearing, talking about some of the things that we're doing, and they said, you know, that's Dana Badgerow's work right there, and that's true. Commissioner Badgerow had a huge influence in this agency in establishing, I think, this business-mindedness and this analytical approach to looking at what can we do to get better at what we're doing. And so what we have is not only the four goals, but then every one of the divisions, every business unit in the agency then establishes specific business objectives. And those are based on information about the customer needs, the cost, and results. Then what happens, and this is an important part of just our internal process, those managers produce a report every quarter, and they meet with the executive leadership of the agency, and we take a look at their progress, and we look at the financial condition of their operation, and we think creatively and openly about how could we be doing things differently. We need to break that mindset of, well, we've done it this way before, we're going to keep doing it that way. That's not what those conversations are like. Every quarter we think, what are the new opportunities in the market? Is there a new piece of technology that we could deploy here? Is there a way to spread our costs across jurisdictions or across a greater number of agencies to reduce that per unit cost? So we're constantly looking at ways that we could do some things differently. In your packet, you've got a little sheet that shows one of the divisions. This is the plant management division for its 2010 year. And I'm not asking you to go and look at all of this detail, but there you could just see the basic four goals that cut across the agency. And then within each of those areas, we've got some business objectives. And that's what we're looking at every quarter. We're looking at those performance measures and looking at ways that we can do some things differently. And again, this will come up a little bit later. But that whole conversation, and it's important in my mind because it creates an ongoing discussion of performance. We really try to create the ethic in our organization that we always talk about performance. Good performance, great. Bad performance, correct it. If we're not talking about performance, ask questions about performance. Use the data to make decisions about where we go next, because that's basically how we can create a continuous improvement culture and get better at what we do every day. Next, I want to just move into some sample business areas. And again, what we want to do is we've got four areas. We want to talk a little bit about the basic approach so you get a feel for what it is that we do in these areas. We also want to talk about recent innovations and results. And then lastly, we're going to talk about, so what have you done for us lately? What are some potential opportunities going forward? Recognizing the rub we have and the resource issues we have in this state, what can we do to help resolve that problem and provide relief to agencies? So if there's questions on anything I just said, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take those. Otherwise, we'll go right into those examples.
Go ahead and proceed. I don't see questions at this time.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask Kent Allen, our Chief Procurement Officer, to join me and walk you through a discussion on purchasing.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and title for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks, Ryan. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer and the Director of the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. What we're responsible for is state purchasing. We've got a few slides to show how the purchasing mission fits in with the admin mission that Ryan was discussing a moment ago. We acquire goods and services for state government, and there's sort of three prongs to the way we attempt to do that. One is trying to ensure that we're getting the best value for the taxpayers' dollars. One of the things we learned is that the cheapest goods and services aren't necessarily the best investment for the state, so we try to balance price and quality and also the various policy of, and social objectives that the legislature and the governor build into our procurement programs. This highest ethical standards is also really a critical one for our success. If we don't do this right, we find ourselves on the front page of the newspaper, and you've all heard stories of literally governors and state executives and so forth who've gone to jail because they haven't paid enough attention to the ethics of state procurement. Minnesota has not had anything like that happen, and we intend to keep it that way. The laws that you've passed are very supportive in keeping this a clean government state. They require open and fair competition. They protect whistleblowers. They address issues such as conflict of interest that are extremely important in assuring that this $2 billion of business is fairly allocated to appropriate vendors. And then the last bullet here is really the legislative policies and priorities that are part of the procurement process. Procurement becomes a vehicle for various social and policy issues. And just some examples, some of our procurement laws really are to assist in the development of small businesses. Others promote businesses that hire disabled people. Others involve environmental concerns and so forth. So those are the three prongs. The Central Procurement Office is a division within the Department of Administration. There are various types of goods and services that are purchased through central procurement, and Our role is a little bit different in each of these areas you see on the slide. With respect to commodities and general services, the Department of Administration is directly responsible for buying those. We frequently do that through statewide contracts. About 1,500 of those are in place now that are available for use by state agencies or, as Ryan mentioned a moment ago, local units of government. We also delegate the commissioner's authority to train buyers and agencies, and there are over 600 of those individuals in across state government. The situation is a little different with respect to professional technical contracts. These are really contracts for intellectual services, and agencies have their have statutory authority to take primary responsibility for those themselves. So the admin role there is one more of oversight and approval. We also do some enterprise-wide professional technical contracts, which is a fairly new concept for us. And then cooperative purchasing. Ryan mentioned this on a state level. We have a program through which over 900 local units of government voluntarily use state contracts when it's to their advantage. We also operate the two largest multi-state purchasing programs in the country. One of those is a pharmaceutical purchasing program that 46 states participate in, and another is a computer purchasing program where most states participate. The volume of purchases in each of those programs is actually in excess of $1 billion a year. So they're extremely widely used across government. But you pull out all of that non-Minnesota and non-state government spending, you've still got an annual state agency spend of about $2.1 billion, which is what you see on your slide. Top categories there, healthcare number one, highway construction and maintenance number two. Everything else falls far behind in terms of quantity of spend after those two items.
Mr. Allen, I'm going to interrupt you for a second here before you move on to your next slide, if that's all right. Representative Quam?
I want to thank you. I see you guys with white hat. I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Mr. Church. And, I see you guys with white hats. I love what you're doing. Having been a treasurer at a school, we've utilized some of your services and the contracts. I've had this question: when you figure out the cost, is there ever a tax revenue to Minnesota computation in that, so that if you have two close bids, but the lower one is from North Dakota, Wisconsin business, and one just slightly higher is from Minnesota, but the tax revenue for property tax, corporate, and income tax goes back in, I always felt that if there was some way of figuring out, it might actually be less expensive because some of that money goes back in.
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't give a preference to Minnesota businesses, and we don't do the computation that you're describing to figure out if there might be instances where, looking at a bigger picture, it would be advantageous to buy from the Minnesota business. The primary reason for that is that most states have, including Minnesota, have what's called a reciprocal preference law. And what that means is that we put every state on an equal playing field, don't give preference to our own vendors, with the understanding that then other states won't give preference to their vendors. So if we were, and actually I believe predating me in this part of state government, there was a short period of time where Minnesota enacted a Minnesota preference law, and the business community fairly quickly said, that's not helpful to us because now other states are discriminating against Minnesota businesses. One of the interesting things that we found when we looked at how Minnesota businesses do as recipients of state purchasing is that even without a statutory preference for Minnesota businesses, we found that over 70% of the purchasing dollars flow to businesses that have addresses in Minnesota regardless. Did that answer your question?
Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, yes, that's very good feedback, and I'll let some of the people who have asked me similar things, let them know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Allen, and we've traded lots of emails. I do have a constituent who has a printing firm in my district, and I thank you so much for your responsiveness. Whenever he contacts me, I contact you, and et cetera. We kind of flow back and forth. But my question was much along the line of Representative Quam's question, because I think that's the kind of gripe of my constituent, is that he has a printing firm in Minnesota, and he pays property taxes, and yet when sometimes the bids are let, it might go to a broker who's working out of their home and not paying the same type of business property taxes as this printing firm is. And so when you say 70% of the purchases flow to Minnesota businesses, did you mean 70% of the purchases by the state of Minnesota? Because to me that doesn't seem like a high enough percentage. Maybe you could clarify that.
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, 70% of the purchasing dollars that state agencies are spending is going to businesses with Minnesota addresses.
Question. Follow-up question, Representative Scalzi.
So then, thank you, Ms. Chair. And Mr. Allen, then, when you look at your legislative and executive priorities, is that where we should be looking at something like this? Because I'm not sure that I've ever gone through legislative priorities as to how we purchase, but I'm kind of curious to see what your executive and legislative priorities, if there's a listing, how that listing might work. Because to me, 70% doesn't seem high enough for what we're purchasing. It just seems to me that I would like to see more going to Minnesota businesses.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, I wouldn't disagree with that, although I when we've run the data, we frankly have been pleasantly surprised that it is that high of a level, given that there isn't a Buy Minnesota law. And as I said, our fear, we obviously want to be as supportive of Minnesota businesses as we can be, and our fear has been that to the extent that Minnesota businesses are given more preferences, that they will lose more businesses in other states than they would gain, more business in other states than they would gain here. So it is a balancing act. We certainly can look for ways to assist Minnesota businesses and do, but anything that would give them a flat-out legal advantage over other states has shown to be to backfire and not achieve the ends that we're looking for.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Could you get to us a listing of your legislative and executive priorities so that we might have a better idea of what that means?
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have an acting commissioner, so we don't really have a, I've got a boss today, but I don't know if you'll be my boss tomorrow.
Sorry, Mr. Church.
And so in developing priorities, one of the reasons we're being a little gun-shy, perhaps, about saying what we think the legislature or the governor could do is that we really don't have a governor's appointee to be working through that sort of agenda with us on at this moment in time. So I think we'll have a number of examples of areas that we think the legislature could explore, but we're a little gun shy about saying do this and this and this because we're kind of in a limbo.
Mr. Allen, do we have an idea of when the appointment will be made, or Mr. Church? Have you gotten any insider information?
Madam Chair, I'll probably be the last to know. We really don't have a good read on that at this point. We're one of three or four agencies left to be appointed.
Okay. Well, maybe once that happens, you can provide us with some information at Representative Scalzi's request. Any other questions on this? If not, we'll move on to the next section, the next slide. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You'll notice that the legislature did a fairly aggressive overhaul of the procurement statutes in both 1998 and 2007. And Minnesota's procurement law has actually been lauded by the Pew Center on the States as a model of excellence for state procurement. And that is to the credit of the Minnesota legislature, obviously. In 2007, most of the changes that you made related to what we would call a more strategic approach to procurement. This means we looked at things less on a purchase-by-purchase and agency-by-agency basis and took more of a big picture or enterprise approach. I won't go through each of these bullets. These are essentially some of the types of tools that can be used when you take a more strategic approach to procurement. I'll mention a couple just as examples. Product standardization, that really involves getting agencies together to decide what they can buy collaboratively. So, for example, rather than buying 100 different models of a computer and buying one each of those models, you would buy 100 computers of the same model, and that can be very helpful in driving down the price. Negotiations is another one I might focus on here, because Minnesota's made some big changes here, and we're still doing something quite differently from how most other states do this. Historically, procurement organizations put out a solicitation and get responses from vendors and then award the business to the winning vendor and pay the price that was offered by the winning vendor in that response. Rather than just paying that price, what Minnesota started doing is really using that as that price as the starting point in negotiations. And we've shown that we can save a considerable amount of money by taking that extra step and working through a negotiation process. Bottom of the slide, you'll see there's a reference to savings and cost avoidance with no dollar there. A very fair question is how much we're saving, but it's an extremely difficult question to answer. It's very hard to quantify some of these savings or cost avoidance because there's so many unknowns. When, for example, we do product standardization and buy 100 of one model versus one of 100 models, we can't really know what we would have paid for those 100 models. We can't really know how much of a discount we're getting because of the volumes that we're offering. So there's just lots of assumptions and estimates that go into determining cost avoidance and savings. But one area where I think we have a pretty tangible and documentable evidence of savings is in this negotiation area, because we can look at the price that was offered to the state in the original solicitation process and then look at how much we knocked that price down through the negotiation process. So looking solely at negotiations as one means of saving money for the state, during the most recent biennium, the state identified over $60 million in savings that we knocked off that original price through this negotiation method. Another number that's been used in some documents, including ones put together by third parties, is an estimated $246 million in overall savings for state work from the period of time of December of 05 through July of 09.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Allen. If we do have several member questions, if we could take those before we move on to the next slide. Representative Beard.
Well, Madam Chair, hearing about this savings, I wonder if my division can call dibs on some of it for transit.
Nope. Oh.
just thought I'd ask. seriously, first a comment to Representative Scalzi's observations about printing. I used to call the Department of Administration back when I was forming my publishing company, and I actually did quite a bit of printing work as kind of an independent contractor relationship with a certain printer. And at some point in the late 90s, that rule changed, and they asked for my employee ID number or something and said, nope, no brokers, no reps. You got to actually work for the company. So that was the end of that wonderful relationship. But it was, I got to say, you had good people to work with. It was a pleasure doing business with them, and when I could be the low-cost provider, I was happy to do the job. But somewhere in there that changed, and it was no more brokering. But along the way here, a couple years ago, we passed some design-build enabling legislation for the Department of Administration. And I remember there was some angst about how you were going to apply it, where you were going to apply it. As you're talking about this innovation slide that's coming up here in a moment, can you just touch on whether it's been useful, whether it's just nice to have that tool in your box, or what have you? Thanks.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have used that as a new tool in the construction area, and actually the person who's even more knowledgeable about that than myself is Wayne Wislosky, who's heading this way.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Wayne Wislosky. I'm the Director for Real Estate and Construction Services in the I appreciated Representative Byrd's work on this over the course of many years, but one of the fundamental principles that we're trying to work into our construction procurement is the idea of competition, not just on price, mm-hmm. but also on qualifications and past performance. We really want to, as we hold ourselves accountable for our performance, we also want to hold our consultants and our contractors accountable for performance. They do a bad job for us. We want that to impact their ability to do business with us in the future. In that 2007 time frame, there was legislation. Originally, it was 2005. There was legislation passed to allow us to use alternative delivery methods in construction, design build, both the price-based selection as well as the qualifications-based selection, construction management at risk, and job owner contracting. Through the history, we've just been doing one-offs. The Department of Revenue Building was a design-build project. It was, as far as I know, the state's first office building that was built design-build. We also then followed that up a couple of years later with using design-build for the retirement systems building. Really, the Department of Transportation, as you know, has been the leader in this, using design-build on road construction projects. Over the past several years, we've focused our efforts first on both using best value procurement and also in construction procurement, but also CM at risk, construction management risk. We currently have four CM at risk projects that are underway. The Capitol, the Dome project, mm-hmm. is a CM at risk project, as well as three others. We've used that method on our larger projects. And we're still learning as we go, but we see significant advantages. And one of the primary advantages that you typically had a design bid build process where the contractor didn't get involved until they won the bid. With the CM at risk project, you were able to bring them to the table, their expertise to the table during the design process. And so they have input on scheduling, on cost estimating, on constructability, really just a tremendous resource to have at the table during the design process. Ultimately, you want to see the actual results of that. You want to see a reduction in change orders. You want to see a reduction in the cost of our projects. We're still getting the results in, but so far we feel that's very favorable. And I just comment on best value procurement. It was a little bit, there was 2007 legislation that provided a unique twist on using best value in construction procurement. We actually used that on the transportation building. Some of you around would recognize that we had replaced the exterior, or did works to re-anchor the exterior panels on that project. Because we had asbestos to deal with, because we had an occupied facility where we had safety as a key issue, in that case we used the best value procurement process. So there we had a complete set of design documents, but we still evaluated qualifications and past performance and used that in our evaluation. Ultimately, the bottom line message of this is the low bid price isn't always the best value to the state. It really is going to depend on how the contractor performs through the project as well as the overall project team.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This would be for Mr. Allen. My predecessor, Doug, Representative Meslow, had worked on the reverse auction plan. I know it saves some money. Are you still using that procedure?
Madam Chair and Representative, we haven't used it in the last couple of years. We used it more aggressively than any state for about 3 years. We were able to get a fixed price contract to do an unlimited number of reverse auctions, and we pushed it because there really was nothing to lose with this fixed price contract. We really used it in any situation where we thought there was an opportunity, and we had some very good results, although this state clearly saved some money in using the process. We tended to not have very happy vendors. Part of it's just the psychology of an online auction process. People tend to get kind of perhaps carried away and forgetting the commitments they made them to themselves as to where they would stop bidding. And we occasionally had vendors that couldn't honor their lowest bids ultimately, or just left it with kind of a bad feeling that they hadn't taken very good care of their own interests. So it wasn't particularly popular with vendors. We did save some money, But what we found for the most part is that as we've switched to more of a negotiation focus, what we think is sort of the same advantage of the reverse auction by using the best bid response as the starting point for discussion of the ultimate price. So we haven't used it in the last couple of years. We're not adverse to using it in selective situations and still could choose to do that, but haven't for a while. We ran it very hard for a while and think we got a lot of advantage, but then found some other ways to get that same advantage.
To Philip? No. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You don't have to address this now, but I'm interested in the SWIFT implementation and how that's going for procurement. But you mentioned a couple of these bullet points for strategic procurement: product standardization, aggregating and aggregating demand. And then I also heard you say that there were 600 trained procurement employees. And I wonder how you ensure that there is consistent standardization across agencies. You mentioned buying one kind of computer. And especially in IT, it's really easy for people to start going their own way inside an organization and not really and finding ways of avoiding the standardization route. So how do you ensure that there's that kind of cooperation with this model throughout the agencies?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we actually have a very strong partnership with respect to computer purchasing. We have a very strong partnership with the Office of Enterprise Technology, and there's actually a process that an agency, you either buy what's on contract, which is the standard models, or you need to go through an online exception process with OET to request any kind of alternative. And none of these standards programs are absolute. I mean, we recognize that there can always be unique situations where there is the need to buy something that hasn't been universally endorsed by the user community. So we do have exception processes for all these, but only by going through to do this correctly as authorized under your delegated authority, you do need to go through an exception process before you buy anything other than what's on the state contract, if there is a state contract for the types of goods and services you're looking for. We do some audits after the fact. I mean, some of it's a trust-based system. We train people on what they're supposed to do. Assume and believe most state employees will try to do what they've been trained to do. And we do some post audit as well to try to ensure that.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, I guess and this does go back to the issue of the account or the procurement system. Is all procurement by the 600 people done through the procurement system? So is there a technology tool? Is there an IT tool that you use to do the audit? Is it all run through the same platform, or how does that work?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we don't have a technology tool to do the audit other than the one that OET uses with respect to specific requests for alternatives to standard technology purchases. But the purchasing that the delegated 600 state agency purchasers conducts is done through currently the MAP system, Minnesota Accounting and Procurement System, and will be done through the SWIFT system when that is implemented.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Allen, did you want to comment about the implementation of SWIFT for Representative Winkler's earlier comments?
Do you want
to save that for a later time?
I can comment now, Madam Chair. The SWIFT implementation has had a rocky year or so.
And also, perhaps, since we do have several new members to the legislature, if you could maybe talk a little bit more about that, about the acronym. And
I hope I know the acronym. Statewide Integrated Financial Tools. This is what would replace the current MAPS system, the state's automated accounting and procurement system. MAPS has been around since 1995. Was old technology. It was technology that wasn't going to be fully supported by the software manufacturers. So the state concluded that although it's a costly and time-consuming process, that we needed to replace the state's accounting and procurement system. That development and implementation process has been underway for just over a year, and it's behind schedule. The current plan is to bring up a good part of the planned system in July of this year, but the original schedule was to bring up the entire system in July of this year, and the progress of the project team has not been such that now looks like a viable option. So a number of elements of this will be delayed. We have a fixed price contract with the vendor, so the vendor is still on the hook to deliver all of the functionality that we contracted for at the same cost, even though we're not getting it as soon as we hoped that we would.
Senator Winkler.
Madam Chair, that's just specific to the procurement component of it, correct? Because that's a slightly different version of events than we've heard in other committees about the accounting system.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, there's still some discussion of exactly what will be implemented in July and what will be deferred, but a good share of what will be deferred is procurement functionality. With respect to both accounting and procurement, the current goal is to bring up anything that exists in MAPS, so there's really not any sort of step backward with respect to the transition from one system to the other. But many of the more exciting, compelling features of SWIFT are on the procurement side, and those are the ones that are less ready to go in July of this year.
Representative Winkler.
And Madam Chair, when I hear this, I start to think of the BIS, the Budget Information System, and the testimony we've had about that is that there really was no commercially available off-the-shelf software product that was able to perform all the functionality that for a budget system that we wanted. And rather than come in and make a request for the full amount of money to build the kind of budget system we wanted, they instead took the budget system that was available off the shelf and they tried to really stretch it, realized that they couldn't stretch it the way they wanted to, and now they're in a position of starting over again. And I guess I want to make sure that we know the state of the procurement system and to make sure that we're not making that same kind of mistake on the budget side. This is not your, I don't think you're the project manager for the procurement side, but I think we need to have a clear understanding of where that's going.
Mr. Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, the SWIFT project is not in a situation that I believe is comparable in any way to the budget system. We're not working on anything that's considered a prototype. We have a contract with a vendor who is legally obligated to deliver a full-scale accounting and procurement system as described in the specifications that the state put forward. That vendor isn't in any way stepping back from that obligation, and the state is fully intending to hold them to that obligation.
Okay, thank you. Perhaps we can have an update later on, too, especially after we get a new commissioner and whatnot. Any other questions before I have Mr. Allen go on? Hope we're not getting behind too far.
Than was anticipated, so I'll try to move really quickly through some of the rest of this. Minnesota has gotten some very nice attention from external third parties with respect to our innovations. The Pew Center on the States did a report which is called States Buying Smarter, Lessons Learned from Minnesota and Virginia. They cite Minnesota for its innovation, its successful negotiations, measurement, collaboration, and persistence. And they talk about some of the key policies in Minnesota that have allowed us to be successful. And one of the reasons I cite these is because a number of these involve the statutory authority in Minnesota, which is to the credit of the state legislature. Minnesota's key policies: a statutory authority for procurement reform, a statutory commitment to ethics and whistleblowers, a robust and independent central procurement agency, and strong joint powers agreement authority enabling two or more public entities to collaborate. When Governing Magazine looked at state business practices, they do a grading the states report every couple of years. In the last report, Minnesota was one of seven states whose contracting and purchasing programs were rated as one of the state's strengths. And the state of Minnesota has won first place in two out of the last 4 years for the Cronin Awards for Procurement Excellence, given out by the National Association of State Procurement Officials. What sorts of innovations are we working on at the moment? You heard reference to the SWIFT system, and I acknowledge that that's not happening as quickly as we would have hoped. I do, on a more positive note, I can say that when that is fully implemented, I think the state of Minnesota will have the most paperless state procurement system that any state in the union has. We're doing a lot of work with enterprise contracts. Some interesting ones include a new program that we've done in conjunction with OET, where we can get a technology consultant on site in a state agency within 48 hours if needed, and at hourly rates that are 25% lower than what the state had been paying prior to this enterprise contract. We have a new travel contract where many of you know in the past state employees are ineligible to collect frequent flyer miles, which means that the state had been paying a price for tickets that in most instances would have ultimately involved some further future benefit in terms of frequent flyer miles. What we now have is a travel consolidator who will be awarding tickets to agencies, not to individuals, but to agencies after they have done a certain volume of purchasing of travel arrangements. So we're finally getting some of the sort of equivalent benefit of that frequent flyer miles through this new enterprise contract. We're also doing some contracts specifically for local units, water treatment equipment, fire trucks, and so forth. And we've implemented, 2 years ago, the legislature asked us to ensure that the technology that the state buys is accessible to people with disabilities. We've had an excellent partnership with the disability community and the Office of Enterprise Technology, and have devised some ways that really respect the interests of all these stakeholders in terms of both assuring that the technology market is mature enough to be providing these products, that we're getting them at a cost that's affordable to agencies, but still maximizing the degree to which we're getting accessible technology. And this balance is actually something that's kind of stymied the federal government and other states as they've tried to implement comparable accessibility legislation. That gets us to the future opportunities. You see that we don't have anything listed there. That doesn't mean they don't exist. It means in large part that we want to work with our new commissioner and new governor and those of you here in the legislature to help us identify those. Certainly some areas for opportunity would include potential for renegotiating contracts, reducing the use of professional technical contracts. And one other topic that's really in your hands is the various legislative priorities that have been built into the procurement process. And these are all areas where there are important social and policy objectives and there are strong constituencies, but many of the things that have been added to the procurement process do add to the cost and complexity. So there's always an opportunity for this body to assess whether your priorities have shifted with respect to these topics. And it includes things like the various programs that give preference to particular types of businesses, looking at where goods are constructed, in some cases looking at the wage rates paid to the immigration status of employees working on state contracts. So there are lots of issues there that could be ripe for some interesting conversations. But again, we're not recommending that you change those, simply that's an area for potential further discussion. I know I've taken more time than you wanted, so I will stop and take any questions and let you move on.
Representative Simon has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I was out of the room for a little bit, but I assume it's been mentioned that some of us saw your presentation earlier this morning at a different committee. In that committee, we had a little discussion. I'd like to amplify it a little bit more about what you just said, which is one of the areas for future opportunities is decreasing to the extent possible professional technical contracts. I take it that that means IT contracts where you bring in outside consultants. Is one such way to do that, to meet that goal, bringing that function in-house? And if so, does that potentially mean hiring someone full-time or on some basis who would be an actual employee?
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I believe in some cases, particularly as new commissioners come in and know that the governor is looking for opportunities in this area, might find some contracts in their agencies that they would think could be eliminated entirely. I don't know how many of those there'd be, but I certainly wouldn't rule out the possibility that there could be some contracts like that. Other instances might involve ones where a cost-benefit analysis of different models could conclude that using state employees would be more cost-effective than using external consultants.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Allen, I just want to touch upon something else that we talked about a little bit, although we ran out of time somewhat in the other committee. The very last point that you made about some of the complexities that are introduced into what you do by some of the things that we do, one of the things that I think many of us, myself included, have voted for before are sort of the Buy American or Buy Minnesota provisions. And I'm wondering if you could just touch a little bit on the kind of complexity that that may introduce. I think it was Representative Erdahl in the last committee who asked about, for example, I think, and I don't know if it's a matter of policy or just a matter of practice or the best deal. For example, in the motor pool, almost all the cars are American cars. There are other mandates that we've imposed, sort of Buy American mandates and or Buy Minnesota. Could you just amplify a little bit that dimension of your work?
Thank you, Representative Simon. I know when you're gone, you touched on it a little bit, but maybe not so much the Made in America, but maybe you can comment on a little bit further. And I know we've got quite a bit of the presentation, so we'll try to whip through these questions fairly quickly. Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, please understand I'm really not complaining about the complexities that the legislature adds. It's one of the things that makes our job challenging and stimulating. So. It's part of what we take some pride in, figuring out ways to make these things work. With respect to the Buy America, there are only a handful of instances where that is a part of Minnesota statutes. And the recent one that's probably gotten the most attention is Buy American-Made Apparel and... I'm sorry?
Flags.
Oh, flags, yes. I was forgetting that, actually forgetting that one. But Buy American-Made Apparel and safety protective equipment, which some people have interpreted to include, like, the guns that our safety officers and so forth use. As we've looked at the relative costs of purchasing, particularly on the apparel side, clothing made in this country versus clothing made elsewhere, it is clear that the state is paying a fairly significant premium to buy American-made clothing. And as policymakers, you're the ones who need to decide if you think that's too high a premium. We can get you some data on the added cost of doing that. In most cases, there is no Buy USA or Buy Minnesota provision, so it's usually not an issue for us. But when it is, it's a complication and can add cost.
Mr. Allen, I would like to see those costs if you had that information available.
We do.
Representative Winkler.
Just quickly, Mr. Allen, if you could comment on whether you've seen an increase in local government units accessing the cooperative purchasing opportunities and what the trend line is.
Mr. Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we haven't really studied it, so I don't have a good answer for you. Just sort of my gut would say it hasn't changed awfully much. as you probably remember, there was a bill passed 2 years ago that didn't require local units to use our contracts, but required them to consider using our contracts, which is a pretty weak mandate, but hopefully got them at least checking us out as an option. But I don't think it's resulted in a very significant change, and partly because most local units were aware of and using our contracts to a large degree already.
Follow up, or does that answer your question, Representative Winkler?
Well, Madam Chair, just 2 years ago, I favored a stronger mandate, but we did what we could.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And very quickly, I wasn't sure whether to ask this under the procurement section or the energy conservation one, which you're getting to, but a few years ago, Representative Broad and I collaborated on a bill around purchasing of plug-in hybrid cars, and I think last year we updated that to include electric vehicles, and I'm wondering whether how that's going. I mean, has the state been able to follow? It wasn't a mandate, as I recall, but I think we gave some direction towards purchase of those very energy conservation vehicles, which are, I think, now being produced much more massively than a few years ago.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Mr. Church.
A couple of points on this. One is the flex fuel vehicles. We're purchasing many more of the flex fuel vehicles, and which use the E85, and then watching E85 consumption, which has gone up. I think we're at about 1 million gallons of E85, which is probably a tenfold over where we started. But then in terms of the vehicles like electronic vehicles, plug-in vehicles, that is on the horizon. We have an agreement, worked with some local units of government and XL Energy to get an experimental vehicle, placing charging stations. So watch this space, and we will have Dave Fielding here in just a moment. And talking about energy conservation, you might be able to say a little bit more about that specific development. But it's beginning. St. Paul just rolled out an announcement of adding those vehicles to their fleet as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And if it's okay with everyone, I guess I'd like to move on. We still have quite a bit of the presentation yet. So maybe if everybody would be okay with it, maybe we can wait till the end of the presentation before asking additional questions so we can speed it along a little bit, if that would be okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Fielding. I'm the Director of Plant Management. And while I don't have time to give you a complete overview of the organization, we're going to focus on one of the principal areas of attention that we've had to show not only that improvement, but also to reinforce the message that Mr. Church gave about the department's goals and how we use those goals in our performance management. We are responsible for the buildings here at the state capitol. There are 22 facilities under our care, custody, and control. Most of them are on this immediate campus. A couple are a little further out, including the retirement services building, the BCA building, and we even have responsibility for the Department of Revenue facility in Ely. That represents about 4.5 million square feet. Energy in those buildings on an annual basis, utility charges are just a little north of $10 million. When we set our annual goals as a work unit, we build those not just for the purpose of establishing our objectives, but also for the purpose of performance management. And so the sheet that Mr. Church referred to previously and that you have in your handouts, that sheet represents my report card to the organization, and it also represents the report card of all of those who work for me. These are the metrics against which we judge our performance each year. And so we set the goal. Actually began back in late 2005 when the state brought three new buildings onto the campus, the Anderson Building, the Freeman Administrative Building, and the Health Ag Lab. That added almost 1 million square feet to our total of 4.5 million. And so the energy impact of bringing those three facilities into the mix was considerable. And as this first chart shows you, starting with the executive order that was issued in the fall of 2005, energy consumption actually was headed in the wrong direction. That executive order called on state agencies to take steps to reduce energy consumption, and simply by monitoring performance, we weren't achieving the desired outcome. So we set a goal of the 10%, and we set a process in place whereby the organization met routinely, not only among ourselves, but among the members of the agencies who occupy our leased facilities. We started by trying to understand the nature of the energy consumed on the campus. As you can see from the pie chart, electricity is the largest component of over 50%, followed by natural gas. Natural gas is a large component for us because we have two buildings which are not on the district energy heating and cooling network. That's the Minnesota History Center, which is heated by natural gas, and also the BCA building out on Maryland. That's followed by hot water and chilled water. We then tried to understand how that energy was being consumed on a building basis, and you can see there's a wide degree of variation both in type but also in amount. And just the two lab buildings that we have coupled with the Minnesota History Center accounts for 45% of the total energy consumed on the campus. Then we tried to understand, we had to make improvements quickly. We didn't have the luxury of money or time to try to redesign things. So we tried to understand the nature of consumption. And one of the things that immediately pops out to you when you do is that over 50% of the energy that's consumed in these 22 buildings takes place when no one is there. This is after the cleaners have gone at night until the buildings reopen in the morning, and particularly across the weekends from Friday evening until first thing on Monday morning. And so if we were to make improvements on a quick basis, we were going to have to drive that consumption, the blue area, down. We were also going to have to try to narrow those red areas, because if we started air handling units a little later in the morning, if we shut them down a little earlier in the afternoon, and we made sure that when things are supposed to be turned on and off, that that's in fact when they are turned on and off, that we thought we could make improvements. It's important to understand that we have here, and it was installed in 2000, a Honeywell software package referred to as EBI, Enterprise Building Integrator. And we are probably the third largest user of that software in the country. We monitor over 60,000 points across the campus buildings that relate to heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems, security, and life safety in terms of fire. So the combination of that ability to monitor on a 24/7 basis and knowing on a building-by-building basis what those consumption profiles look like, and then constant attention not only by our staff but also by the representatives from the agencies and the buildings that we serve, began in earnest in the summer of 2009. This shows you what happened once we got serious about this subject. From that point on, and ever since, we have dramatically reduced energy consumption across all energy types. And the summation of that trend, as measured by the end of the fiscal year in 2010, was the total energy consumption from all types was down over 14%, and that we saved, in terms of hard dollars, actual utility charges, $1.2 million. And that actually represents a net savings, because over that period of time, rates, particularly in the electrical area, continued to grow. This chart shows you where we've gone for the last 6 months since the end of fiscal year 10. As you can see down there on the lower right hand, we've basically bottomed out. We've stabilized, and in other words, we've taken advantage of everything that we can hope to gain from just pure operational changes. We'll continue that, but to go even further, we've got to now begin to look for opportunities to invest in changing systems, and I'll discuss now with you a couple of those changes. You drive past our parking ramps, and we have seven, you'll notice whether it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 3 o'clock in the morning that the lights are all on. That's because the lighting in parking ramps traditionally, not just here on the campus, is powered by high-pressure sodium lights, the kind of the yellow glow that you see. And those lights are either on or off. And obviously there are safety implications in parking ramps, particularly after hours when we have session going on into the late night. We have to be ensure that we have lighting on. So the question really in parking ramps, not just for us but for all operators, is how do you provide sufficient light when you need it but scale back when you don't? And technology has given us the answer. This light that you see here is produced by a subsidiary of Philips. They're manufactured in Texas. And we've been beta testing this light in the 14th Street parking ramp for close to a year now. We've done some iterative work with the manufacturer on design, and we think we've got it right now. It is an LED fixture. It is different than some that you see because instead of seeing all of the individual points of light that are typical of LED, the LED in this fixture are actually focused upwards, and that reflector across the top then distributes the light. So the quality of light improves dramatically. In addition, each of these fixtures has two controls in them, each individual fixture. They have a motion control and they have photoelectric control. So consequently, the way it works is when there's movement in the ramp, either or in the area of the ramp, either by a vehicle or a pedestrian, the light will power up to its full level. After it's timed out, and if there's been no subsequent movement, it goes down to 10% of total energy, which is sufficient in terms of lumens output for life safety, but it is dramatic in terms of its energy savings. So the combination of savings that comes from going from high-pressure sodium to LED and the ability to control when that light is used, we have validated through our own test in the 14th Street ramp that we reduce energy consumption, electrical energy consumption, by 90% with these fixtures. That's been validated now by the PB, who will be a source to us for funding. So a combination of some federal stimulus dollars and PB financing, this project now is on a fast track for implementation, and you'll see that coming into the parking ramps around the Capitol campus. I mentioned to you about the Honeywell control system and that we control HVAC's equipment. We control life safety and fire, but we have not controlled centrally lighting in our buildings. And we have not been able to do that simply because we didn't have the capacity on the network to handle that level of data. We've now just recently upgraded the network. It is in place now, and the integration now of lighting control in our buildings will take place. There is another initiative which we can take, a relatively low-cost initiative. Technology in fluorescent lamps is improving all the time. There is a new 800 series fluorescent lamp which reduces energy consumption by over 30% and maintains the same levels of lumens. So group relamping of our buildings will ensure that we can begin to take advantage of those energy savings as well. And finally, PV, which is an institution created really by help from the legislature and coordinated through the Real Estate and Construction Services, is an entity that can be called upon to come in and do formal studies of buildings, building systems, building lightings, and lighting. And when efficiencies can be found that have sufficient payback, then they provide a source for funding to allow those changes and improvements to be made. We have all of our buildings on a list. We have already completed several. All of our buildings will receive that analysis, and our future improvements will be guided based upon what those reports tell us. So that's a quick snapshot of energy. We've saved a lot. We've got a lot more we can save, and I hope you recognize the effort that's been put forth.
We have just a couple of questions from members. If we can handle them quickly before we move on. Representative Quam?
Madam Chair, Mr. Church, I'm not anticipating you'll have this off the top of the your head, but if you could get back to the committee, what would the energy and dollar savings be from migrating to a state cloud?
Madam Chair, Representative, state cloud in terms of computing services, is that what you're talking about? We can probably work with our Office of OIT to help get that information together.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Church. The other question is, with the new fleet of flex fuel vehicles, what is the effect of mileage of, you know, E85 usage, et cetera, versus regular gas in a dollar figure? In other words, poorer mileage, you know, what is the additional cost that we're paying to use that?
Mr. Church.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, I'm struggling to come up with it. There is a difference. It's a little lower mileage on the E85 vehicles, as you probably know. It's a close call, and we'd have to do a little bit of analysis for you to show you, but we do have that information. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in one answer to the question that Representative Quam asked is my employer did a look into that by fleet or flex fuel vehicles, and he figured it was about 50 cents a gallon difference that it had to be to make it cost competitive. But that's not my question. The question I had is one of our members earlier expressed some frustration. They were trying to get our desk lamps have all got incandescent bulbs in them, and they wanted to get some CFL bulbs. I mean, do we have those available? Have we looked at changing that out as far as putting those in supply so when those are replaced, because those do save energy? And like I said, this representative expressed some frustration, tried to get one, and was not able to get one through the offices here. I mean, is that something we're looking at also to go through?
Right. Mr. Fielding.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, the only incandescent bulbs that we stock are the historical bulbs that we're compelled to use over in the Capitol for purposes of the history. We do not. Everything that we stock is fluorescent CFL compact fixtures. So if someone had a need for a lamp from plant management and we weren't able to supply it, we must have been out of the type that it needed, not because we don't stock it. So if you can give me some particulars, I'll be happy to follow up on it.
I'll have them contact you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Representative Nelson. Perhaps maybe that's a better question for our own house supply, or?
Well, that's part of plant management's responsibility, so I'll be happy to take it.
Okay, thank you. Maybe we can move on to the real estate portion then.
Madam Chair, members, again, Wayne Wislosky, Director of Real Estate and Construction Services. And I'll try to go through this as quickly as possible. I know we're running a little late on time. Real Estate and Construction Services has four primary areas. We have responsibility for oversight of construction projects on behalf of state agencies. We have the Enterprise Real Property Project that we'd love to come back and talk to you more about. And we have the energy, the PB program that Dave mentioned, as well as B3 benchmarking and sustainability. The area that we're here to talk about today is focused on our leasing activities. Leasing is a centralized function performed by Real Estate and Construction Services on behalf of state agencies. The benefits of this structure are you have a professional staff experienced and trained in the industry negotiating leases and performing lease management functions. You have the state's space standards and guidelines applied consistently across all state agencies. These leasing activities are both for state-owned facilities. The tenants in our state buildings on the Capitol complex all have leases, as well as when we're leasing in the private market. I'll first touch on the leasing activities in the 22 buildings that plant management is responsible for. I'll just first start with a snapshot of the state's overall portfolio of owned facilities. There is 5,426 buildings, that state-owned buildings, that consists of 30,500,000 square feet of space, And those buildings are managed by 20 different state agencies. And you'll see on this piece the different uses that are out there for our state facilities. As far as the leasing activity, I'm going to focus specifically on the admin buildings here that plant management is responsible for in the Capitol complex. A key metric that we have for our leasing group is the vacancy rate in our PMD buildings. And the reason why that's important, if we have vacant space in I'll use the Centennial office building, the cost of that vacant space then gets spread across to the other state tenants. You still have heating, you still have lighting, you still have cleaning. So driving that vacancy rate down, keeping that vacancy rate down is important. And in the Capitol complex, we think we're getting excellent results. We're at 0.17% of space in the office space in the Capitol complex is vacant. So that is really, you know, we're expecting as the budget impacts, that there's going to be churn in real estate, there's going to be programs that change, there's going to be reductions. That's a continuous process, but again, that's a key metric for us is keeping that leased our admin buildings fully occupied. We are working our storage. We have one building where there's a significant amount of vacant space in a storage facility. We're currently working on a project with several state agencies to fill that space. Jumping over on the slide that you have that's up on the screen, this is really relates to our non-state-owned buildings that we lease. And I'll just give you some quick highlights of that. In the 7-county metro area, we have 196 leases. 111 of those leases are primarily for office space. Non-metro, we have 590 leases. 238 of those leases are primarily office space. In total, we have 3.6 million square feet of lease space statewide, and that is through 786 total commercial leases. The annual rent on that space is $62 million a year.
Representative Winkler had a question for you on that point.
Not on that exact point.
Okay.
Sure. My question is just about the IT system that we funded a while ago, and I was surprised to see this not in your slides, and I wondered if you could just touch on that at some point in your presentation, how, you know, whether you have an ROI for us on that or something to share.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that is the Enterprise Real Property system that I touched on. We would absolutely love to and be delighted to come back and give a more comprehensive presentation on that, or if a one meeting with you individually on that. We really see that it's still in implementation, but there's a lot of value to be realized from that enterprise system.
Okay, well, we'll look into that later the session then, if that would be okay. And as you're going through this on this slide, I actually had a question too.
Sure.
With the $62 million in leases, that's a large number, and I'm wondering what attempts have been made, or perhaps a better question is how often it's reanalyzed to make sure that we're getting the most efficiencies. So if we've got different boards, board of pharmacy, or perhaps the board of barbershop, I can't remember what that board is called, but what do we? Yeah, there is a board on barbers, but barber board. What attempts have been made to make sure that we're getting the most efficiencies out of those leases, and how often are those things kind of looked at again to make sure we're getting the most bang for our buck? And otherwise, is there a way we can perhaps look at some of these boards and get some more efficiencies? If you could comment on that a little bit. And also maybe you could comment on the Ford building as well.
Madam Chair, I'll be happy to. I'll answer the first question. There's probably several different parts to that related to the cost of the space. One is obviously the rental rate, and I'll talk briefly on rental rates and where we're at it compared to the overall market. The other is really on space utilization, how much space are state agencies utilizing to do the work that they need to do. And then the other is just opportunities for co-location of facilities, and the boards are and councils are one that's often looked at as far as can we locate them in a manner where they can share the copier, computer functions, accounting functions, business support functions. the councils and boards, those smaller agencies, are really ripe for that type of opportunity. So I'll probably just continue with the presentation and first hit on a key metric for us, for our leasing group, is how do we perform in negotiating our leases compared to market rates. We benchmark ourselves against the market rates in our various cities and communities that we have leases. And overall, on average, we achieve at or below we're performing better than the market rates on average. That doesn't mean that on average is the key part of that, because there are leases that are higher than the average, and the market's constantly changing. So a lease that you negotiated 3, 5, 7 years ago may not be, there may be opportunities for reducing that in today's market. So we do continuously look at opportunities to renegotiate leases, and I can just give a few highlights of leases that we renegotiated over the last year. The health boards, which is one of the boards that actually is in a co-located facility, we have renegotiated a 10-year lease, and over that 10-year term, through reducing the rental rate, we are saving $2.6 million. Corrections and Mink Corps, we renegotiated a 10-year lease, and we're at $1.3 million in savings through reduced rent. Higher education, that's a smaller square footage, but over a 7-year term, we're saving $381,000 through reduced rent. We do have a number of larger leases that we're currently in the process of renegotiation. The Office of Attorney General space, the Minnesota Lottery, indeed, are some of the ones we're actively working to renegotiate. So with respect to rental rates, we're always looking at comparing ourselves to the market, seeing how our leases are performing. Oftentimes in renegotiating leases, what the landlord is looking for, we're either getting towards the end of the term of the lease and they want to extend out. They obviously want to keep their space filled. Vacancy is a big issue in the metropolitan area. So we're able to leverage that. We'll offer them additional years if they reduce their rates. With respect to space utilization, and this really touches on what we feel we can do, our opportunity to help agencies be more cost effective is how can they do the work that they need to do in less space. And over a year ago, we met with General Mills, and this was a broader effort, and Tom will talk about that later related to the lean. But General Mills had implemented over a 3 to 4 year period a pilot project at their corporate offices using flexible work environments. Industry reports suggest that if you just did a walk around and did a survey, you'd find that assigned workstations are only occupied 40% of the time, that 60% of the time an assigned workstation is vacant. That's either because somebody's on sick leave, vacation leave, or they're out on meetings, or their job is more mobile, or they're currently working on telecommuting. So that represents a significant opportunity, in our view, to help agencies essentially do the same work they're doing today, but do it with less space. And so we're currently going through a process to update our space standards and to incorporate flex work environments, following General Mills model, and hopefully can promote that within state agencies.
Okay. And do you have an update for us on the Ford building? Why is that still open? And
Madam Chair, members, about, I want to say it was 3 years ago, that or 3 to 4 years ago, there was a work group put together to evaluate the options related to reuse of the Ford building. The analysis, you know, from our standpoint, essentially concluded that from a cost standpoint, renovating that building for an office use was not cost effective compared to either new office space or leasing existing space. But there had been a prohibition in place on demolition of the Ford building. The legislature had passed this law that prohibited us from doing that. That has been sunsetted, but it is still, I think, a matter for the legislature to decide. There's certainly a historical preservation argument to be made related to the Ford building. I think the legislature has to decide, are they willing to pay, you know, a premium to have that building preserved and reused.
How much are we paying?
On average, it's about $25,000 a year that it costs us, Dave, is that correct? But that does spike. We've had a couple instances where that cost has been significantly higher. If you've seen the exterior of the building, you see some of the bricks, the spalling that's happened, and we've had to do some corrective work. We've had some roof leaks as well. So we've had it's a building that's deteriorating as we speak, and so there's ongoing costs associated with that.
And since it's deteriorating, are there issues with insurance and things? I mean, I would think that would be a liability problem.
Vacant buildings are, in any city, are a potential, you know, not only from a security risk, but there's there's nobody in that building on a day-to-day basis, so you aren't tracking on a day-to-day basis what may be going wrong with that building. So there is, the brick spalling was a perfect example where we were fortunate we didn't have a brick fall and hurt someone in that case. So it certainly is a liability concern. It's a security concern. It's not heated. So it's really not actively being maintained. But it really is, a decision point that we have to come to collectively on what should happen with that building.
Thank you. I think that would be wise, but I won't hold you up anymore if you want to. We're about coming to the end of our time, but it looks like the presentation's almost over, so hopefully it'll work out.
Madam Chair, I'm really done with the presentation. I would stand for any questions that you may have.
Madam Chair, ready for Lean?
Ready.
Okay, we'll go with that, and Tom Bauman.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the table.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Bauman. I'm director of the Enterprise Lean Program, and in deference to the short amount of time, I'll try to be very, very lean in my comments. I would welcome an opportunity, if you see something that interests you, to come back and talk to the committee more. But the program is housed in the Department of Administration, but it really is a cross-agency or cross-government enterprise where we are working with all 24 cabinet-level state agencies with the goal of trying to introduce, sustain, and continuous process improvement activities within all 24 cabinet-level agencies. I'll give you an update on where we're at near the end. What we do is really to apply the lean tools. And I'll talk a bit about that in a minute as far as what those look like. First of all, lean, for those unfamiliar with lean, this is not, lean is not an acronym, which is amazing. If you've been in state government a long time, it's actually not an acronym. It's more of an adjective. It describes what happens when you look at your process level of organizations and truly try to figure out the best, most efficient, highest quality ways to produce whatever it is you do and wherever you work. A key part of this comes out of the origins that has been around probably since the 1920s. So if someone says, what's this new lean thing, it really has been around in some form or fashion for about 90 years. It has a lot of similarities with Six Sigma or with total quality management, if you've heard of those as well. The thing that differentiates lean from those others that has a really strong focus on trying to figure out what's the most efficient way to do something while maintaining high quality. Another thing it attempts to do and does very well is it engages the people who do the work in making the changes. This isn't about the commissioner coming in and saying, starting Monday, we're going to do it this way. It's about engaging those people, the frontline workers, and who do the work currently, into identifying and making the improvements. And so it really addresses this change mentality and helps people get over the fear of change, because they are the architects of change. You describe the future that you want to achieve and you engage them in reaching those. We've also, in our efforts, tried to invite and encourage other public entities to be part of our training, to be part of our Kaizen or rapid process improvement events because process doesn't really care where you work. We have so we've encouraged people from the counties and from the cities to come to our training and be involved. We've also had participants from the MinSCU, the college systems, and the University of Minnesota as well. And we've also developed some nice partnerships with the private sector. Mentioned most fully is our ongoing relationship with General Mills, who has been very gracious in offering us their expertise as well as time from their senior leaders to come and talk to our senior leaders about what they've been doing. They've been doing lean at General Mills for about 15 years. During that time, they have saved $5 billion, according to their figures, in their operations. And so that's an ongoing and very positive partnership that we've maintained. We have done, so far in state government, we've done 171 rapid process improvement events, or we call them Kaizen events, where you focus on a particular process, you bring a team together, and you look at how to make that process the most lean and efficient as you can. And these are the results of those efforts. We see on average a 66% reduction in the elapsed time of producing whatever it is we do, a 45% reduction in task time. So the actual work that you do in order to produce that thing is reduced almost in half. And those combinations of savings that we see on a event-by-event basis comes to about $90,000. And we've been able to sustain these at a level of about 80%. Minnesota is one of three states that has an enterprise effort underway. The others are Iowa and Ohio. And I am constantly getting calls from across the country and across the world about what's going on in Minnesota, because a lot of, as you are well aware, a lot of the public sector is under tremendous pressure to find more efficient, effective ways. And in my view, if you talk about reform, this is what reform could and should look like, engaging the levels of the public sector together to figure out efficiencies and move ahead. I just want to share one quick example. We have many, 100 or more to share. But this one has to do with an example we did in the Department of Human Services. Department of Human Services has over 40,000 people that are licensed private personal care attendants, PCAs they're called, and maybe you're familiar with this. And these are the people that come into homes to provide health services to people that need it. They need to be enrolled in the program every year. And before we did the event, it would take an average of 58 days per enrollment paperwork to get someone in the program. And it took, on average, about 12 hours of work time to make that happen. After we did our lean process improvement event, we reduced that 58 days down to an average of 3 days, and we reduced the amount of work time down to 6 hours. If you multiply 6 hours times 40,000, it comes out to about 8 FTEs worth of time that's saved by implementing and sustaining that over time. And like I say, our average is about $90,000 of staff time that we see typically saved by doing this. We engage as employees to make these changes, and so they are part of what we see happen. As I mentioned, I would be glad to talk more about this. I could talk endlessly about lean in state government, but I will stop there, and if there are any questions or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Bauman, and thank you, Commissioner Church, and all of your testifiers today. We really appreciate hearing from you, and we appreciate your efforts to innovate and to leverage efficiencies. So thank you for coming today. With that, I will adjourn the meeting.